Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. Before diving into today's topic, a few quick announcements. First, I would like to make our new visitors aware that our podcast is available for no charge on iTunes and can also be accessed via our RSS feed. Both of these options are available on our website, www.researchonreligion.org. Just look on the right-hand column. And there on that right-hand column, you will also see links to our Twitter and Facebook pages, where you can keep informed about upcoming interviews and share some of my thoughts on some of the interviews that we've published. This year, we are making a major effort to reach a broad audience with our free educational podcast and ask for your help in spreading the word to your friends, colleagues, and members of your congregation if you happen to be in one. Finally, I want to remind folks that we are sponsored by Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, which, in addition to this show, also provides a wide range of free services for people interested in learning about the social scientific side of religion. This includes easily accessible research papers, policy reports, and news about upcoming talks and seminars. Please check them out at www.isreligion.org. And now, on to today's topic. Over the past several decades, perhaps since the onset of the Iranian Revolution in 1979, Western scholars have become increasingly intrigued with the phenomena of Islamic fundamentalism, sometimes referred to as Islamism. Most of the attention has been devoted to the more militant side of this movement, with particular emphasis on understanding the increase in religiously motivated violence. Likewise, there has also been interest in the political side of this movement, especially now with the recent events emanating from the Arab Spring, including an electoral victory by the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. But what about economics? Has there been an Islamic reformist movement attempting to set boundaries as to what is appropriate or inappropriate behavior for Muslims in the world of commerce and financial transactions? Our guest today, Professor Timur Kuran, has argued convincingly in his book, Islam and Mammon, The Economic Predicaments of Islamism, that there is an important economic component to Islamism, and in order to understand political Islam or Islamic fundamentalism more generally, we need to look closely at where the Islamic economics movement originated, what it advocates, and what some of the consequences of its policy prescriptions have been. Timur is a professor of economics and political science and the Gorder Family Professor of Islamic Studies at Duke University. He is the author of numerous articles on economic history and Islamic economics, as well as several books including The Long Divergence, How Islamic Law Held Back the Middle East, which we featured on a podcast last year, and one of my favorite economic books of all time, Private Truths, Public Lies, The Social Consequences of Preference Falsification, which I cannot recommend highly enough because of its wide application to life in general. We'll have links to all of these books on our website, so please visit them. Today, we will be focusing on his book, Islam and Mammon, a book that I use in my own course on religion and politics, and which provides a fascinating look at the topic of Islamic fundamentalism without getting bogged down in a lot of the emotion-laden normative rhetoric that unfortunately surrounds this phenomenon. Timur, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you for the invitation.
Okay, let's start out our conversation by looking at what Islamic economics is. Allow me to quote a passage from your book. You say, quote, "Of all economists of the Muslim faith, only a small minority known as Islamic economists identify with some variant of this new doctrine. Yet it is socially significant only because it advances the sprawling and headline-grabbing movement known as political Islam, Islamic fundamentalism, or simply Islamism," unquote. Now, in that passage, I emphasize the word new, because it is important for understanding the somewhat surprising genesis of the ideas behind Islamic economics. But before going there, give us a general idea as to what Islamic economics is.
Islamic economics is a movement that seeks to restructure economies of the Islamic world according to prescriptions found in the fundamental sources of Islam. The fundamental sources of Islam are the Quran, the religion's holy book, and the Hadith, which are recollections of the Prophet Muhammad's doings and sayings. Islamic economics claims that the prescriptions found in the Quran and the Hadith are sufficiently detailed to offer adequate guidance to a modern economy. It claims that if Muslims lend according to the prescriptions found in the fundamental source of Islam, if they save according to those prescriptions, if they invest according to those prescriptions, that Muslims will be more prosperous in general, Muslim economies will perform better, and that the distribution of income and wealth in these economies will be more satisfying.
I think all of those are major concerns within a number of Islamic economies as well as economies throughout the world. When you were talking about this, you talked about hearkening back to the fundamental doctrines of Islam, the Quran, and the Hadith. But I want to talk about the origins of this movement in particular, the Islamic economics movement. And as I noted just a moment ago, and as you have written, this is a relatively new movement. And by relatively new, we're talking about, I'd say the past 70 or 80 years, which is recent in comparison to the long 1,400-year history of Islam. So when and where did this idea or this body of ideas known as Islamic economics originate?
So Islamic economics emerged as a doctrine toward the end of India's colonial period. It emerged as part of a very broad campaign to preserve and advance the religious identity and the traditional culture of India's very sizable Muslim minority. About 20%, 22% of India's, colonial India's population was Muslim. In the 1930s, there was mounting agitation for Indian independence. The movement advocating Indian independence was Hindu-led, and most of its members were Hindu. Against that background, increasing numbers of Muslims came to fear that India would soon be dominated by Hindus and that a Hindu-dominated India would subject them to hostility and discrimination. And these worries were compounded by a rise in the indebtedness of Muslim farmers, mostly to Hindu moneylenders. There were Muslim notables who argued that the best response to these developments was for Muslims to reassert their cultural autonomy, to show communal solidarity, and that this required demonstrating that Muslims had a distinct way of life. One component of the campaign that emerged to show that Muslims in India have a distinct way of life was the rise of Islamic economics that purportedly showed that Muslims have a distinct way of conducting their economic affairs. That is the rise of Islamic economics. It goes back to the 1930s and became popularized in the 1940s.
Yeah, I find it interesting that it arose in India, because I think most of our listeners would guess that it arose in one of the major Arab Islamic countries like Egypt or Saudi Arabia. But the fact that there was that conflict element between Hindus and Muslims seems to be one of the catalyzing factors of this entire movement at its beginning. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. This was critical. It emerged as part of a movement to reassert a communal identity. And the same issue did not arise in Arab countries where the population was very heavily Muslim. We need to remember that there was always economic thought in the Islamic tradition, going way back to the earliest days of Islam. The leading thinkers of Islam did spend time worrying about economic matters. They thought about taxation. They thought about lending money. They thought about interest rates. They thought about distributional issues. But they did not develop a distinctly Islamic doctrine of economics.
Mm-hmm.
And they were quite ready to borrow economic ideas when the need arose from other civilizations. Islamic economics in the 1930s arose as a doctrine that whose proponents self-consciously marketed it as a distinctly Islamic approach to economics.
Now, one of the central figures that you mentioned in your book is somebody named Maududi, and he, again, is from the Indian subcontinent. He might be Pakistani. I'm not quite sure about that. Tell us a little bit about his role in originating this movement of Islamic economics.
Maududi was an Indian, though he moved to Pakistan and became a Pakistani after the foundation of Pakistan. And he was the founder of a political party called Jamaat-e-Islami, the Party of Islam in India. And when he moved to Pakistan, he formed Jamaat-e-Islami Pakistan, which remains one of the major political parties in India. Maududi formed this party in order to promote the cultural autonomy and communal solidarity of Muslims. He as part of this general goal of promoting the interests of the Muslims of India, he felt a need to develop certain distinctly Islamic concepts to distinguish the way Muslims did things from the way Hindus did things and Westerners in India did things. So he developed, coined a variety of terms and developed a variety of concepts, such as an Islamic constitution, such as Islamic politics, such as an Islamic state, and Islamic economics. He was a prolific writer and a great orator, and he was quite successful in promoting the notion that Muslims actually did have a culture that was distinct from Hindu culture, not just in terms of religious rituals and religious beliefs, but in every sphere of life. And he wrote dozens and dozens of books that developed this notion in a variety of areas. Many of them deal with economics.
Now, one of the things that you cite about Maududi's writings is that he was out to promote modernization without Westernization. And if you look at the cultural context of the world at this point in time, you're at the verge of decolonization. World War II is approaching or is being fought at this period of time. You have Kemal Ataturk moving in a very Western direction in Turkey prior to World War II. And so he's writing within this context. And so the issue of, well, the Islamic world is moving in a more Western direction seems somewhat of a concern to him. What did he mean by that idea that he would promote modernization without Westernization?
Well, he sensed that Maududi sensed that Muslims would disappear as a community if they did not modernize in the sense of learn how to invest in a large scale, learn how to lend resources, transfer resources on a large scale, learn how to use modern technologies. He did not think that there was any conflict between Islam and modernization per se, but he believed that if Muslims adopted modernization in the guise of Westernization, that Islam would lose the attachment of Indian Muslims and Muslims in general around the world to Islam would diminish, and that the religion would eventually wither away. So for that reason as well, he felt that it was important to convince Muslims that in modernizing, they were doing so in a distinct way. So banking was not a part of traditional Islamic civilization. You don't find any banks in Islamic economic history up to the 20th century. He felt that if banks were viewed as Western institutions, as distinctly Western institutions, and Muslims use these banks that they perceived as Western institutions, they would learn to see Western civilization as superior to Muslim civilization, and that would harm the religion. So he felt that he needed to develop, or that the Muslim community needed to develop, a distinctly Islamic alternative to the Western Bank, an alternative that would allow Muslims to borrow and lend and invest in distinctly Muslim ways, in distinctly Islamic ways. If they did this, he felt, they would be proud of their religion and they would feel that they had modernized, they had embraced the civilization without adopting foreign customs.
Now, one of the interesting things about Maududi's thought, and he is, again, as you mentioned, is very concerned about modernization, but he's lumped into this idea of fundamentalism. And fundamentalism usually harkens back to the origins or fundamentals of the faith. And so there's a component of this within the thinking here. Now, Is this what Maududi and his followers were doing, is trying to resurrect some ideas that was perhaps circulating during the Golden Age? Now, again, with banking, as you mentioned, they didn't have banking per se back then, but were there other ideas that they were trying to resurrect from, you know, the early days of Muhammad?
Well, this is what makes Maududi such an interesting thinker. He tries to have it both ways. He tries to draw on the fundamental sources of Islam. In the case of banking, it would be the ban on interest that would lead to, that would point to a different way of organizing the world of finance, and it would point to different financial institutions. He wants to draw on the original principles. At the same time, he has his eye on what is happening in the wider world, and he wants Muslims to catch up. He feels that creativity and innovation is as much of Islam as the original principles are. And he feels that there is no fundamental conflict between drawing on the original principles and promoting the original principles and modernizing. So he's trying to do this. He's trying to self-consciously draw on original principles and make the new institutions, the new modern Islamic institutions, appear grounded in the original sources while also satisfying modern needs.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you mentioned, he had a more global outlook to his philosophy, in that he was, while situated in India and concerned about the specific situation in India, he's thinking more about what you termed an imagined ummah, or what is this ummah thing?
The Ummah is the global Muslim community, the original Ummah was the first Muslim community that was led by the Prophet Muhammad. It was initially persecuted and then was successful in defeating its persecutors and formed the first Islamic state. And then the Ummah, that Ummah, became larger as other people were converted to the faith, and Muslim-governed lands expanded. In Islamic thought, from the beginning to the present, there has been this notion of a borderless ummah that is supposed to show solidarity with toward other Muslims. So he saw the struggle of Indian Muslims as part of a global struggle on the part of all Muslims to shake off colonial rule and also to modernize, while his immediate purpose was to rejuvenate Indian Islam and subsequently to promote Pakistani Islam and the Islam of the Indian subcontinent. His wider goal was always to promote Islam globally and promote solidarity among the Muslims of the world. He considered his wider audience to be the Muslim Ummah, the broader Muslim community, and he has been read by Muslims everywhere.
And it's important to note that the Muslim world, when we often think about it here in the United States, we tend to only think about the Middle East, but it really is expansive, stretching from Morocco in northern Africa all the way around the globe to Indonesia, and encompassing, you know, large portions of Central Asia, parts of Africa, as well as the Middle East. So how does this philosophy, this theology, get spread around during the mid-20th century? Are there policymakers or governments in other places that are picking up on these general themes and trying to implement them, or is this just largely an intellectual movement?
I would just add to what you said a moment ago, that only one out of five Muslims today is Arab. 80% of the world's Muslims do not speak Arabic as their major language, if at all. Most of the world's Muslims are located in Indonesia and Southeast Asia and the Indian subcontinent, and of course also China. Only a minority of all Muslims are located in what we traditionally call the Middle East. So now to come to your question, for about 30 years, Islamic economics remained an intellectual exercise. There were no governments that warmed up to this idea, not even the government of Pakistan, which was run by secularists who paid lip service to Islamic ideals, but did not want to really really put into practice any of Maududi's ideas. And there were no governments anywhere else who took him seriously. There were thinkers in the Arab world and elsewhere in the wider Islamic world who sought to build on his ideas. The most important of them are two Egyptians. Hassan al-Banna was the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and Sayyid Qutb, who was also a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, an activist who came after al-Banna. Both were killed. In one case, it was an assassination, and in another case, an execution that followed a trial by the Egyptian government because they were perceived as threats to the secularist modernization agenda. So you did have movements led by intellectuals who warmed up to Maududi's ideas, felt that the culture of Muslims had eroded, it needed to be rejuvenated, Muslim communal solidarity needed to be promoted, and that an important way of doing this was to develop, to promote an Islamic way of life. But they did not have any practical successes until the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of those practical successes then? How does this get implemented in life?
Practical successes came in the 1970s during the oil boom. The oil boom brought enormous wealth to Saudi Arabia and the other oil sheikdoms of the Arab world and oil-rich countries of the Arab world that these countries suddenly became the governments of these countries suddenly found themselves controlling huge resources at a time when there's a great deal of discontent in the Arab world, in these countries themselves, but also the wider Arab world, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, and the leaders of these suddenly much wealthier countries felt that they needed to legitimize their regimes. They're quite oppressive regimes that were perceived as quite also quite corrupt. And as part of the strategy to legitimize themselves, they started promoting Islamic causes around the world in return for literature that would produced around the world that would be favorable to them. They also started supporting campaigns to put Maududi's ideas into practice. And one of the projects that originated in Maududi's idea was Islamic banking, which of course was simply an idea, a project that remained on, that was on paper and remained on paper until the 1970s, but the oil money of the 1970s actually was used to establish the world's first Islamic banks in the Gulf. Within a few years, they had branches elsewhere in the Islamic world and also in the Western world. This was the first success of the of practical success of Islamic economics. The Saudis and other leaders of the Arab world, other conservative leaders of the Arab world, who controlled a lot of oil resources, took credit for the foundation of the first Islamic banks. So this was one success. Another success is they started promoting redistribution according to Islamic principles. Islam early Islam put in place a taxation system called zakat that was used partly to finance charity. It didn't last very long. It was implemented for about 30 or 40 years in the 7th century, and subsequently rulers stopped implementing it. But it has always, zakat has always remained in Islamic thought as an ideal taxation and subsidy system that not only required the wealthy to share their resources with the poor, but also took care of the disadvantaged in society. Zakat had not, from the 7th century to the 20th century, had not been implemented by any state, by any Muslim-governed state. The Saudis assisted several countries, most importantly Malaysia and Pakistan, to create modern zakat systems, which collected zakat taxes from wealthy Muslims and use the resources collected to partly to finance charity.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back.
This was another success.
Yeah, I want to come back to each of these successes, Islamic banking and the zakat, because there are some interesting unintended consequences to these things as well, too. So with those two successes, the other question I have that's related to the spread of this, you mentioned that the Saudis picked up on this, they're trying to legitimize their regime. Are there any other constituencies within society that are picking up on this? Does this have a special appeal to the poor? Does Maududi's ideas resonate with that group, or maybe artisans or the middle class? Who is this also resonating within society?
It didn't initially. It did not quite resonate with the poor. It did resonate with the religious functionaries around the Islamic world because they had been marginalized from the 19th century onward, all modernizing reforms had served to marginalize them, had created new functionaries in society who start performing roles that had traditionally been theirs. Maududi's program, which required every policy to be grounded in some way in Islam, suddenly created a new demand for people with an Islamic training. So around the world, they became fans of Maududi and fans of movements that were based on his ideas.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go ahead and talk about some of the specific elements of Islamic economics, and we've already touched upon two of these. Your book does focus on three main areas. We already talked first about, one, the prohibitions on charging interest in Islamic banking in general. The second, as you also mentioned, was social welfare provision or charitable giving, the zakat. And then the third one, which we haven't got to, and it's a little bit more ambiguous, is the creation of new economic norms that seek to, in essence, create a less corrupt society. So I want to address those one by one. We already started talking about Islamic banking a little bit, and this is one of the main economic issues that comes up with the discussion of religion economics, is issues of prohibitions on interest, and this relates to the banking industry. And it's not just interest. We perhaps could say usury or excessive interest. And this is a theme that we see in Judaism, we've seen in Christianity, we've recently talked with one of your former students, Sharon Rubin, on this topic. But I'm curious to know, what do Islamic economists, referring to that minority group of economists that are following these more fundamentalist views of Maududi, where do they come down on this issue of interest?
Well, the Quran very explicitly bans a practice known as riba. Now, this was a practice that involved charging interest for a loan, but also doubling the interest payment required if that payment was not made on time. Because in the ancient world, most borrowing, the vast majority of all borrowing, was for consumption purposes, was to finance consumption. People who borrowed and were unable to make restitution on time typically failed to make restitution when that rate was doubled as well. And the consequence was that they ended up becoming enslaved. Mm-hmm. They had, or ended up, in order to pay back their debt, selling family members into slavery. This was, as you can imagine, among the poor, among people who found frequently that they had to borrow from wealthier members of society. It was a hated institution. Islam banned the institution called riba, and this ban accounts partly for its the religion's popularity and the Islam's success in spreading very very rapidly. From the beginning, Muslim theologians were unsure about whether the ban on riba covered all forms of interest, including forms of interest that did not involve a doubling of the payment due when restitution was not made in time. However, And that and so the issue of whether all forms of interest are illegal remained controversial down to the present. It has never been resolved. There are people in every age, you could find people who took the extreme position that Islam bans all forms of interest, that riba was simply given as an example in the Quran. And there are others who view riba as usury, in other words, excessive interest. They believe that moderate interest is perfectly compatible with the spirit of Islam. In the Ottoman Empire, which dominated much of the Middle East for several centuries, the courts took the view, or most courts, most judges took the view that that Islam banned excessive interest. They allowed interest-based contracts, provided the rate of interest was below 20%. But just to make sure, they also required the contract to be written in a form that did not involve interest explicitly. So various tricks well known to medieval Europeans as well, such as the double sale, were used to make a loan seem as two sales rather than an exchange of money for a return in form of additional money.
Well, this is something that is a practice today within Islamic banking. I want to come back to that. But one of the things that you mentioned, which is very interesting to me, is how loans changed over time historically. As you mentioned, they started to be, or they were largely consumption-based several hundred or thousand years ago. But as time progressed, interest became more and more crucial for investments, for creating new industries or expanding industries that are existing. And I can imagine that Islamic scholars had to wrestle with this idea, is that, well, maybe the consumption loan is not really good, but what about a business loan for somebody who wants to start a bottling plant or something?
Well, this is you make a very good, very important point. The even though the vast majority of loans 14 centuries ago were consumption loans, a smaller and smaller share of all loans over time were consumption loans, production loans, or loans provided to businesses to carry on a business or to buy equipment, started playing an increasingly important role. Maldudi did not have any training in economics, nor did Qutb, or nor did al-Banna. They missed that important transformation and wrote as though all loans were consumption loans. It's not until the first Islamic banks were established and that they started receiving requests for loans from businesses that Islamic economists started to think about the distinction between consumption and consumption loans and production loans.
Mm-hmm.
In Maududi's writings, you don't find the distinction, and you don't, in fact, see the distinction made until the 1970s in the Islamic economics literature, which is, of course, which deals with abstractions and enjoys the luxury of not having to deal with practical matters.
And that brings us to these practical matters, because as you mentioned, the 1970s, Islamic banks are starting to be set up, and the question of interest is always central to a bank, and they have to deal with this. So how do they go about dealing with what Maududi is writing and the economic reality of that interest is a very important mechanism within a modern economy?
Well, another element of economic reality is that people who invest money in banks have to earn, they're in business, they have to earn money somehow. And if they simply follow the rule that they're supposed to lend money at zero interest, they are going to lose money. Their capital is going to diminish fast, and you can imagine, especially in countries with inflation, which essentially includes all countries of the Islamic world, that there will be a very high demand for consumption loans. There will be many people who will want to borrow $10,000 today to pay back $10,000 next year. And if you consider that some share of the loans will never come back, will never be repaid, the problem will be even more serious, and the bank will not be able to retain capital. So they have to quickly figure out what to do with consumption loans. First of all, how to curb the demand for consumption loans. And the way they did it, without requiring borrowers to pay interest, is to impose what they called various fees, transaction fees. The transaction fees were set at levels high enough to discourage borrowing. So these banks have never made many consumption loans. To make a show of it, many of them have made a few small loans to poor people, but this has not been one of their major activities. Much of their lending has been to businesses to finance production. And there they have come up with a different solution. What they have, and here we find that the theory and the practice diverge. Let me tell you about the theoretical solution they came up with. And if you'd like, we can talk about why that didn't work and why, in practice, they have used a different solution. They've actually operated quite differently. The theory was that the Islamic Bank would operate on the basis of profit and loss sharing. Profit and loss sharing is a principle that the venture capital industry uses. You can think of the venture capital companies in Silicon Valley. People come in with ideas about new software, new hardware developments, new high-tech gadgets. Some of the ideas are very good. The companies that take out venture capital make a lot of profit. According to the contract that company signs with the venture capital company that is providing the capital, Part of the profits, a certain share of the profits, goes to the venture capital company. In case the company is unsuccessful, well, the capital never comes back, so the losses end up being shared. The company that has put up perhaps some of its own capital absorbs part of the loss, and the company that provided some of the capital, the venture capital company, absorbs the rest of the loss. Well, this way of operating mimics the partnerships that were common in the medieval Middle East, and that operated according to Islamic law. So the theoreticians that developed the principles of Islamic banking and who wrote the charters of the first Islamic banks decided that the Islamic banks would lend on the basis of profit and loss sharing. They would operate, in other words, like a venture capital company. They would lend to promising businesses for a share of their potential profits, and with the agreement that, with the understanding that if the company is not successful, they might not get anything back, or they might get back less than they put into the project. No interest would be involved. And they thought that the system would provide capital to people who had good ideas but did not have connections, that did not have collateral, and that it would lead to an investment boom.
Now, I could see that there's going to be a big problem here, though, looking forward, because if this is all about risk and risk sharing, and I have an idea and I don't think it's really going to fly, I'm all for profit sharing because I can push off some of the losses and risk to other people. But if I'm an entrepreneur that has a sure bet, I don't want to have to share profits with anybody. I'd rather go to a traditional bank that's going to charge me a fixed rate of interest, say 3%. And if I think I'm going to get a 5% return on my investment, hey, that's what I want to do. I don't want to share those additional profits with anybody. Is this what happens?
Exactly.
Okay.
That did happen because in these countries where Islamic banks set up shop, there were also conventional banks. And what happened is that people with very good ideas went to conventional banks. People with very risky ideas went to the Islamic banks, and the Islamic banks found out very quickly, in fact, at the end of the first year that they went into this business, that they were making mostly losses, that profits were quite uncommon, and that they were getting a very large share of the very risky investments. So in response, they sent people to the best business schools in the world to get training. There must be a way to separate the good risks from the bad risks, to identify the particularly good projects. If there wasn't a way, the venture capitalists in Silicon Valley wouldn't be so successful. The venture capital industry wouldn't be so profitable. So they within a few years, they had well-trained people evaluating the projects, but that still didn't solve the money from the Islamic banks maintain, as is quite common throughout the Middle East, multiple sets of books, one for the tax collector, one for the insiders, the people who sit on the board, who tend to be family members or very well trusted people. There were many cases of profitable companies that had borrowed from Islamic banks that reported low profits to the Islamic bank in order to share less of their profits with the Islamic bank. So the Islamic banks quickly learned that if this system was to work, they had to have someone on the board. They had to put a member of their own bank on the board of every borrowing company. The companies were reluctant to have bankers sit on their board for fear that information about their true profitability would go to the government. And for this reason, the fact that corruption is very high in these societies, profit and loss sharing does not work quite well. The very reason why there hasn't been much of a venture capital industry in the Middle East, particularly in the Arab world and in Pakistan and Bangladesh, places where corruption tends to be very high, is precisely that there is a great deal of corruption and there's a lot of mistrust among potential business partners.
So what did the banks then do? They still want to lend money and they still want to make money. So did they have, they're not going to do the profit sharing techniques. Did they engage in conventional loans or somehow manipulate these rules other ways?
So they had to go back to the drawing board and figure out some other way that sounds consistent with initial or early Islamic principles, early Islamic practices, seems to have a religious dimension to it, an Islamic dimension to it, but that does not involve the problems that profit and loss sharing has. And what they came up with was this idea of commodity financing, which is actually a practice that goes back more than 1,000 years in the Middle East. It has an Arabic name, Murabaha. It is a body of Islamic law that supports it, that legitimizes it, and they have been using this as a way of doing ostensibly interest-free banking. So what this involves is a company that wants, let me do it through an example. Let's suppose a company needs to buy a new fleet of cars or a new fleet of trucks. One way to do it, of course, is to go to a conventional bank and borrow $1 million that is needed to pay for the trucks, borrow that $1 million at 10% interest and pay back $1 million and 100,000 at the end of the year, pay it back to the bank. The way the Islamic bank does it is that the bank takes the order for the trucks costing $1 million. It buys the truck on its own account, and then it turns over the trucks to the company that needs the new fleet of trucks, and it sends the company a bill for $1,100,000 payable in a year. It calls that $100,000 transaction fee, or uses some other term of that nature. From an economic standpoint, the transaction is the company that wanted the trucks in the first place gets to use the trucks immediately. From an economic standpoint, this transaction is indistinguishable from an interest-based loan. The Islamic economists say there is a difference. There's a fundamental difference, which is that for a certain period, the bank owns the fleet. It's, after all, the bank that orders the fleet of trucks. And for a certain period, it owns those trucks. During that time, if the trucks are damaged by lightning or they're stolen somehow, the loss will fall on the bank, not the company that is interested in using the trucks.
So the bank is sharing some of the risk.
So the bank is bearing some of the risk. But the bank, of course, is interested, as a profit-maximizing company, it is interested in limiting its risk. In practice, it keeps that period, its own period of ownership, very short. Initially, they kept it to a few days. Within a year or two, some banks realized they could simply do this at the click of a mouse and transfer ownership after a few seconds to the company, and they figured that they could simply reroute, never have the trucks arrive and sit in their own parking lot, that they could just route the trucks directly from the producer to the company that wants to use the trucks, that this could all be done on paper. So essentially, they end up doing conventional finance, using on paper a cumbersome contractual form that is equivalent to, in practice, to interest-based finance.
Yeah, so it's just really kind of a trick of wordplay in that respect.
It's a trick of wordplay, and what makes an Islamic bank different from a conventional bank is that every practice of an Islamic bank is subject to review by a body of theologians, by a body of religious functionaries who earn rents, who get paid a great deal for this service. Another thing that differentiates an Islamic bank from a conventional bank is that the Islamic bank uses some of its profits to assist Islamic movements, just as a conventional bank will use some of its profits to assist the neighborhood, to assist museums, to assist universities. An Islamic bank does the same thing. It does use some of its profits to assist various causes. These causes tend to be Islamic causes. This is among the things that legitimizes the Islamic bank in the eyes of people who realize that it is not really doing finance all that differently from a conventional bank.
Now, that brings up the issue of charity and charitable giving. And the other aspect that we had talked about earlier is this idea of zakat, which is a social welfare mechanism of trying to assist those in need from those who have a little bit more. And we got a few more minutes left. I was wondering if you could give a brief rundown of how Islamic economics views the zakat and also some of the unintended consequences that have arisen in trying to implement this via government policy.
So zakat, as I said earlier, is an early Islamic taxation and subsidy instrument. Initially, in the first few decades of Islam, zakat was paid by the owners of particular commodities at designated rates. So people paid 2.5% of their precious metals as their zakat tax to the Islamic State each year. They paid a certain share of their agricultural crops, depending on various factors, their costs. So depending on their costs, they might pay more or less. And there were eight categories of recipients, including the poor, widows, people who were serving the Islamic State, in other words, employees of the Islamic State, and so on.
Now, one of the questions I just want to back up before we get to who gets this stuff is how it was paid, because what I found in your book, which was utterly fascinating to me, was that there was a scheduled rate for if you had this kind of metal, you would pay this rate. If you had this kind of agricultural crop, you would pay that rate. One of the things that they never anticipated was the value of oil. Oil wasn't there. It was actually a nuisance in many respects during that period of time. So how did they deal with the issue of the valuable commodity known as oil?
Well, they didn't. They didn't have a rate for that. It was not considered a valuable commodity. So in 7th century Arabia, no rate was declared for that. In fact, you bring up an important, quite important point, that the system of taxation involved rates for commodities and forms of income that were known at the time. And the rates on silver and gold and wheat and camels and sheep and so on were all based on the value, the relative values of these commodities in 7th century Arabia. Zakat did not emerge as a system of taxation that would be applicable over a long period of time where during which relative prices are changing and new commodities are emerging and new technologies of production are emerging. One of the reasons it became useless or started to be deemed useless by rulers within a few decades is that Islam, because it was so successful, spread to parts of the world where economic conditions were quite different. The capital of the Arab Empire moved within a few decades from Medina in Western Arabia to Damascus, where economic conditions were different, the economy was a lot more sophisticated. Yet many of the forms of income, major forms of income in the Syrian economy, or for that matter the Egyptian economy or the Iraqi economy, were not known in Arabia. and relative prices were different. So rather than tamper with the original rates and be perceived as impious, be perceived as challenging Islam, rulers opted to develop new taxation systems and let zakat wither away. And it's not until modern times that zakat was rediscovered, and that some people, namely Islamic economists, sought to redeploy zakat as an instrument of redistribution.
Mm-hmm. Now, this instrument of redistribution, as you mentioned, goes to eight different categories of recipients, the poor, widows, etc. When this is implemented in the 1970s and 80s, a number of governments feel pressure from Islamists to undertake this. Is that what happens? Is this a great social welfare mechanism that goes to the poor and to widows? And
well, it is treated as it is launched as a redistribution system that will reduce the disparity of incomes, that will transfer resources from the wealthy to the poor. And there is reason to believe that, in fact, it did do that in the in 7th century Arabia. When we look at the commodities on which one paid zakat, like camels were capital goods. They were very, people who owned camels owned important means of production. And the poor did not own camels. So taxing people who owned camels ended up transferring resources to the poor. The modern applications of zakat have involved largely modifications of the initial rates, and in some places the initial commodities. Since the initial commodities were mostly agricultural commodities, the people paying zakat have ended up in some places being primarily the poor, and the recipients of zakat have typically been wealthier than the people paying into the system. So there has been, it has led in some places to perverse redistribution. I should point out that it is quite widely accepted now among Islamists too that applying the initial zakat system faithfully in the modern world will result in perverse redistribution. So there is great support now for modernizing, updating the system so that it actually does take primarily from the wealthy and provide for the poor. But there is no general agreement as to how that will be done.
Well, that leaves me with my final question here on this podcast. You talk about rethinking the mechanisms for which zakat is being implemented. What do you see as the future of this Islamic economics movement? Again, we trace this back to Maududi some 70, 80 years ago. It's been around. It doesn't get picked up in a serious way by policymakers until the 1970s. Is this a flash in the pan, a flash in the historical pan, or is this something that is going to be around for the next century?
I think that it is, symbolically, it is still significant. There is a significant constituency across the Islamic world that believes that economics should have a religious dimension. I think the constituency is large enough that we can expect Islamic economics to be around for some time. By the same token, I think that the very simplistic prescriptions of Islamic economics will be revised, and I think that we can expect Islamic banking also to undergo a major transformation. There will also be a large constituency in the Islamic world that will continue to treat Islamic economics as lacking in substance, and they will continue to look for economic solutions primarily in secular thinking.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is definitely some food to thought to think about here, especially as we're going through this process known as the Arab Spring, and as a number of folks in Egypt from the Muslim Brotherhood are being elected into office. We'll see how those economies change over time, and we'll have to have you back to maybe discuss that a little bit. But for those of you who are really interested in this topic, we've only scratched the surface on this, and I really recommend the book Islam and Mammon by Timur Kuran to you. We can find links to it on our website, as well as his most recent book, too, The Long Divergence, where we've had a podcast earlier. Well, Timur, it has been wonderful talking with you, enlightening as always.
I've enjoyed this again.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.